Hello, and welcome to our third NABBW teleseminar for June 2011. Our topic tonight is of special interest to us boomers who have been wondering when and how we'll be able to retire. So the topic is the new retirement, what you must know and do now if you're considering relocating. In a moment, I will introduce our guest, Jan Coulinane, but first, let me introduce myself and do a bit of housekeeping. I am Ann Holmes, the Boomer-in-Chief of the National Association of Baby Boomer Women, which is found online at www.nabbw.com. We also have a forum at boomerwomenspeak.com. If you're not a member of the NABBW, you're welcome to join us. You'll find a handy link on the upper right-hand corner of the front page of the NABBW website, which you can use to join. This teleseminar is an example of one of the many benefits we provide our members. We have approximately 90 teleseminars, which we've done in the past, which are available via written transcript and audio recording. These are yours with membership in NABBW. You won't see them if you're not a member, however, because they're archived in the members-only area. Now that I've mentioned those sorts of things, let me tell you a little bit about the format of the call tonight. I'll be introducing our guest, Jan, in a moment, and she and I will spend about 30 minutes discussing what you need to know and do now so that you can retire in the place that you want to live. And after that, we'll open the call to questions from our audience, and we hope that you'll bombard us with them. Now, enough of my preamble. I'm sure you're anxious to hear what Jan has to say, so let me introduce her, and we'll get right into our discussion. Jan truly is an expert on the new retirement. In fact, she co-authored the book on it, that book being The New Retirement, The Ultimate Guide to the Rest of Your Life. The first edition reached the number two rank on both Amazon.com and BarnesandNoble.com, and the book was chosen as a book club selection by the Washington Post. In addition, the Post's finance columnist, Michelle Singletary, chose The New Retirement for her book club selection and recommended it as a great gift. Jan has been featured on TV, radio, and in many newspapers and magazines, and as our NABBW associate on The New Retirement, is also a regular contributor to our website. Through her company, Retirement Living from A to Z, Jan conducts retirement seminars. Her clients include AARP, the Ford Motor Company, the Smithsonian, Wells Fargo Advisors, the federal government, and Ameriprise Financial. She is working on a new book about single women and retirement, which will be coming out later this year. Jan has a BS and master's from the University of Maryland and is ABD, which stands for All But Dissertation, from Rutgers, the State University of New Jersey. She can also speak backwards fluently. I was going to try to say that fluently backwards, so, but then I realized it wouldn't necessarily sound like it was backwards. So much for that plan. Jan, welcome to the call today. Before I launch into our questions, why don't I give you a brief opportunity to say something about that new book?
Well, thanks, Anne, and welcome to everybody who's on the call. I'm delighted to be here and think NABBW is a terrific group of women, and glad to be part of it. As Anne mentioned, I'm actually working on a new book now. It's about single women in retirement, whereas the first book was holistic and targeted to men and women, whether part of a couple or single. This book is about single women in retirement and talking about relocation. You may or may not know, but single women are the second largest group of home buyers. They buy about 22% of homes, and I think builders are really starting to recognize that it is an area, it is a group, it is a demographic that can't be ignored. So happy to be here.
Excellent. Thank you, Jan. Now, we promised to answer a lot of questions this evening, so let's start at the top of that list of questions and get started right away. Let's begin with what three questions must we ask ourselves before deciding to retire?
Yeah, because here we're talking about maybe moving when you retire, but I always think you got to start thinking about, you know, should you retire? And You can really almost distill it down into three simple questions that I think says it all. The first one is, when you're asking yourself, should you retire, is number one, do you have enough? Of course, that has to do with the money. Do you have enough money to live on for the rest of your life? The second, have you had enough? You know, are you ready to maybe leave whatever your career has been and start to embark on this new second half of your life? And thirdly, do you have enough to do? And as we know, those three questions, do you have enough? Have you had enough, and do you have enough to do, really sort of summarize things pretty succinctly. We all know that as far as do you have enough, we've all been reading in papers and magazines, seeing it on the internet, that women, really the new retirement a lot of people are saying is now that we're going to have to work longer because we've been in and out of the workplace, we make less than men. One good thing, I think, is that we're not it's not a good thing, but it's something that can be changed, is that we're not as good negotiators as men. In fact, there's been a lot of research on this, and they found that women, starting with their first job, they just don't negotiate as good a salary in general as men do. And then when you compound that over many, many years of working, it makes a tremendous difference. And women will compare negotiation to going to a dentist, while men compare it to a ball game. So there's a whole different attitude about
that
it there.
That is a different attitude.
It is. So even if we're perhaps maybe in the end of our career, that our first career or second or third or fourth, it's certainly something to think about if we have adult children or grandchildren, particularly girls, to be looking at that concept of negotiation. It's a skill that certainly can be learned. That idea of have you had enough? You know, for many people, work does provide so many things. It gives us structure to our day. It gives us social support. It gives us feelings of contributing, intellectual stimulation, you know, not to mention that paycheck and maybe health insurance. But have you had enough? You know, are you willing and are you ready to go on to something new? And finally, do you have enough to do? Because work does provide so many things for people, or over time they've developed all their social support system. If you do relocate, you know, how are you going to be able to substitute those things, make new friends? You know, what can you do, what will you do with your 168 hours a week you now have if you've been in a career and now you're leaving it? So those are three questions. Do you have enough? Have you had enough? And do you have enough to do that people should think about?
Excellent. I think that I don't have the answers to those, but obviously I can't retire yet.
And many people don't, but there are things you can start thinking about, certainly, because it really is a process. I mean, like you're saying, thinking about it now, it's a process and not an end. So as you're going through and sort of planning out your next 5 years, 10 years, 15, 20, is it something you want to do? And retire is a word, it's kind of almost a four-letter word now. You know, there's so many words like reinvent yourself, refire, reignite, that a lot of people think the word retire, since it means sort of a withdrawal, should be banned from our vocabulary, because it's really not like we're withdrawing from something, instead considering it moving on to a different phase of our life.
All right. Good point. Well, as we decide about moving on to this different phase of our lives, what do we need to consider when we're asking that question of should we stay or should we go? I think that based on personal observation, I think there are people that go and then realize that they made a mistake.
That can be very true, and in fact, and I'll throw out one of these terms right now, there's a word to describe people who move multiple times. They're actually called fan bees, for find a new backyard, you know.
Okay.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of cute acronyms going around nowadays that deal with relocation and just retirement in general, but FANBEE could certainly fit a scenario like you're saying. People who move, pick up and move totally to an area, you know, feel suddenly they're cut off from their friends or cut off from their support group, from family. It's too hot, it's too cold, you know, it's an area where in the winter maybe it's great, but in the summer it's too hot for them. So they could be a fan bee. They're looking to find a new backyard, something that works for them. You know, they may be like Dorothy, and there's no place like home. There are other people that just like that sense of adventure and like to pick up and move. Some, you know, will move overseas, say, for example. We'll try living in perhaps a master plan community, then maybe become halfbacks, for example, those who live far south, or you've probably heard that term before, and then they move halfback, such as North Carolina or Georgia or something, to be closer to their families who are further up north. So, yeah, some people definitely should stay, and of course, that's a perfect option, and a lot of boomers do say that they want to age in place. In fact, the percents are high, but when they do the surveys of a lot of people, a lot of times they're 65 and older, so I think sometimes those numbers, when they talk about the number of people that want to age in place, they're a little misleading, because a lot of people might have moved when they're 55, 56, 57, 60, 63, and then they're asked, do you want to age in place, and they're saying yes, but they've already picked up and moved. So, and I do want to point out, I'm not a realtor, so the research on the book was really just looking at all these places and experiencing them, and has nothing to do at all with any sort of benefit I get out of anybody buying anything, because I'm definitely not a realtor. But as far as, you know, should you stay or should you go, I kind of like that question, because there's an old British punk rock group called The Clash, and that was a song, you know, should I stay or should I go? And I thought, well, that really kind of fits with this whole idea of relocation. But if we look at who's planning on moving, there was just a survey done in 2010, and this is when the market was not doing well, the housing market, and about a third of boomers did say they plan to move. This is a Pulte boomer survey. And about half of those who plan to move do expect to relocate to another state. So, you know, with 78 million boomers, and this was a survey targeted to boomers, there are a lot of people thinking that they are certainly going to pick up and move. And why? Well, you know, keep in mind that as we age in place, maybe some of our friends are going to move away. Maybe our houses no longer work for us anymore. You know, if you have your bedroom on the top floor, for example, in a single family home, if you have a basement and you have the washer and dryer down there and you're trying to think long term, maybe your home just won't work for you as you would hope it would. You know, maybe you don't want to do that yard work anymore, again, if you have a single family home. Maybe you thought you were going to stay there because your kids were going to stay there, but your kids pick up and move away. Maybe you're tired of the climate. You don't like the snow, or maybe you don't like the heat and decide you're going to move north. I mean, there can be a lot of reasons. Cost of living is a big one. And in fact, now cost of living is the number one reason why people say they want to relocate. It used to be all about climate when the housing market was going nuts. Now it's about, where can I move and make it be a little bit less expensive. So all of those are important things to think about. And what I'd like to say about whether you stay or whether you go, there's one concept that's very important, and that's this concept called universal design. And universal design is the idea of making your home, whether it's a condo, a townhome, a single family home, an RV, wherever you're going to be calling home, to make it so that you can live in it as long as possible. So, for example, if you've decided you love where you live, you want to stay there forever, but you're going to make some changes, say, in a bathroom, you know, put in higher countertops, put in those comfort height toilets that, as we get older, so much easier to get up from, putting in rocker switches instead of the smaller little ones like you'd find in older homes, levers for door handles instead of knobs that are harder for arthritic hands. You know, do you have a place to put in a first floor bedroom or multiple story homes? What they're doing now, which I think is very clever, is stacking closets on top of one another. So if you wanted to put in an elevator somewhere along the line or needed to, you've got the shaft built in. It's all these closets, you know, stacked on top of one another. Maybe you wouldn't have any more room for your clothes, but at least you'd have an elevator to go up and down. So, because they talk about our houses being Peter Pan houses to a great extent, like we're never going to grow up. but we do, and this idea of universal design, if you're looking at a new home or you're looking to make changes, it's really something to be aware of.
All right. Excellent. So you put in the next question, how does behavioral economics play a role in relocation? And I'm curious about that, but I think we should probably start by defining what is behavioral economics.
Yes, this is, I'd say within the last 10 or 20 years, this is sort of a new way of looking at how we actually behave. And there are a number of books out there about behavioral economics. Behavioral economics combines the two disciplines of economics and psychology. And if you think about economics, pure economics kind of assumes we're all rational beings and that we do everything very thoughtfully and very much with just our brain. Whereas behavioral economics looks at how we really behave under certain circumstances and really turns out that we're often, as one of the famous authors who wrote Predictably Irrational, it's a book about behavioral economics, Dan Ariely, that we're a lot more like Homer Simpson than we are, Mr. Spock of Star Trek fame, that we don't always think rationally. So, and they've started realizing that behavioral economics, how we really behave, really can affect so many of the things that we do. And I wanted to give a couple of examples about that. And especially making them applicable to, say, relocating. And one big one is called an anchor. And we've done that, I can use the analogy, too, of clothing, something we're familiar with. We go in, we see something marked down on sale, but it's got the original price there. So, a $40 shirt, now it's marked down to $12.99. Well, we think it's such an incredible deal, but why? Because we've created that anchor in our mind that, hey, this shirt's worth $40, but I'm getting it for $12.99. So we suddenly change our thinking to think, wow, what a great deal. Whereas if we went and pulled the same shirt off and the original price was $12.99, we might look at it and say, well, geez, this isn't even on sale. I'm not going to bother buying it. So that idea of an anchor, they found, is huge, especially when it comes to selling our home. Because, think about it these days, obviously, most of us, if we bought a residence, it's not worth as much as what we thought it should be worth or think it should be worth. We have an anchor in our mind of what we think it's worth. And so when we go to sell it, it's very difficult because we're thinking, our anchor is, our house is worth $300,000, but guess what? None of the houses are selling for $300,000. They're selling for $180,000, but we just can't pull the trigger and do it because we have that anchor. So that's one example of behavioral economics, that we come up with this number and we fixate on it, and then we really can't get beyond that, and it can be sort of a self-defeating behavior. Because think about it, the next house we buy, if it's in an area where the prices have gone down more than ours have, we could be getting a fabulous deal, but because we have that anchor, it makes it difficult. And it brings us to another kind of behavioral economics idea, which is the idea of too many choices out there, or analysis paralysis. When you think about it, why did we end up living where we're living? It's because our parents lived there, because we went to school there maybe and just stayed on. We got a job there. Maybe if you have a significant other or spouse, because they were transferred there. So we end up living somewhere, often not because of our own choice in many cases. But now when you think about relocating, oh, my gosh, you have the entire world virtually that you can choose from to move to potentially. And it almost becomes a paralyzing kind of a thing. And they've really done a lot of studies, and they found that sometimes, narrowing your choices to maybe three or four good ones is much better for people because it takes away this paralysis of analyzing things too much. And in fact, they did one little study that was very interesting. It was like a store, and they had some samples of jams that people could go up and try. And so, these are all these behavioral economic studies they did that I find so fascinating. And so what they did at first, they tried 6 different jams, and they offered them, and people could sample them. And in this mm-hmm. store, about 30% of the customers stopped and tried the jams, and about 30% actually bought at least one jam after being able to stop and do that. Whoop, there goes my doggy barking. All right, and then they did another thing with these jams. Instead of having only 6 jams, they put out 24 different jams.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
And what happened? More people stopped, twice as many, 60% instead of 30%, but only 2% purchased. They were so overwhelmed by the choices that they went into paralysis and couldn't. So that's an actual study that they did where they came up with these concepts and under many different things. So that's one thing. So besides an anchor and besides this analysis paralysis or too many choices, there's another one that we all experience called loss aversion. We're averse to loss, and that means we feel worse about things we lose than the things we gain. So, for example, you know, with the stock market, they've documented we feel worse when we lose money in the stock market than if we gained, you know, an equal amount
mm-hmm.
that we lost.
Okay.
Same with our house. Have this loss aversion. It's tied up with the anchor. We think our house is worth something, but, you know, a certain amount, but if we're going to sell it for less, we're so averse to that it stops us. So those are some examples where behavioral economics can play a role in relocation, how it can actually affect our ability, and by realizing that they're there and that it's a thinking pattern, that we might be able to get beyond that.
All right. I can, as you're talking about it, I can think of people that I know that I've seen being in this situation. So I hadn't realized what they were going through, but you've clarified that and it's crystal clear for me now. So assuming that we decide that we are going to make a decision to relocate, what should we look for in a retirement location?
Okay, well, let's look kind of general, some general considerations. As I mentioned before, climate used to be the number one consideration. And in fact, somebody said to me once, and I thought it was really cute because, of course, the Southeast is very popular, and so is the Southwest for relocation. Someone once said to me, people don't like the temperature to be less than their age. I thought that was
okay.
Kind of interesting. People don't like the temperature to be less than their age. I thought, okay, well, that kind of sums up the climate thing. A lot of people are looking for warmer climate. So mm-hmm. climate's certainly a big consideration, but as I said now, it's shifted more to cost of living. And I'll talk a little bit about that because that's something else we need to consider. But, you know, for example, and there's so many things like on MSNBC, on Yahoo, you know, list after list, where are the good there was just a recent one on Kiplinger, tax heavens and hells for retirees. You know, there's so many things about where is the least expensive place to retire. Well, there's mm-hmm. a couple of considerations there. And first you got to figure out how is your retirement income going to be taxed? Because, you know, of course it depends. What are your sources of retirement income and how are they taxed? Obviously, you know, there are 9 states without an income tax. You know, it's Alaska, mm-hmm. Florida, Nevada, Hampshire, South Dakota, Tennessee, Texas, Washington, and Wyoming. But, you know, is that the only consideration if you're looking at what it's going to cost. Well, of course, absolutely not. You know, you got to look at sales taxes, property taxes. You got to look at car insurance. You know, I lived in New Jersey at one point, and they had the highest in the nation. It was a killer. How are your pensions going to be taxed? Are there going to be homeowners' fees where you're going to live? If you're in a community, and we'll talk about homeowners' fees, that can be a huge wallop to your budget, and that you're going to be paying for fees to live there. So you have to keep that in mind. One easy way to look that up is there's something called the ACCRA. It's you know, it's kind of like how the AARP used to stand for the American Association of Retired Persons, but now it's just called the AARP. They don't want to call it
retired.
Long word. Right. They don't want to use that word retired. And the ACCRA is kind of the same deal. It used to be like a group of chambers of commerces that looked at the cost of places. And the ACCRA is based on 100 for an average cost of living in the United States. And then they give numbers for these areas. And an area has to be big enough. There has to be a big enough population. And, for example, New York, you know, when you think of 100 being the average cost of living in the United States, and the ACCRA for an average is 100. New York is 218. So it tells you that, you know, living in New York is twice as expensive, and I'm sure we'd all agree, as other areas of the country. Washington, D.C., 141. Houston, Texas, 91. Jacksonville, Florida, 94. So you can get some sense, and the ACCRA and that cost of living, what it looks at is a number of things. It looks at food, it looks at clothing, it looks at housing, it looks at sort of like a market basket of goods and services that we would be buying, and it would give you a rough idea of what it is. So if you wanted to, if you're looking at a place and thinking about maybe living there, you can put in like into the Google search bar, ACCRA, and then put in like 2011 because they come out with quarterly numbers, and then put in your area, like, you know, like I said, Jacksonville, Florida. And you can usually get it that way. The ACCRA does have a site, but you have to pay for the information. But a lot of people do things in their marketing for areas, and they'll put what their ACCRA is, because they'll also put in a few others to show how they're much less expensive to live there. So that's a good way to look at things, this ACCRA, this cost of living, because it's more comprehensive with a lot of things. But it's still, you still need to look at how your pensions and how your retirement, if you have a pension, how your retirement income is going to be taxed. So besides this idea of climate and cost of living, which are all biggies, I think really we all need to come up with what are our non-negotiables? What is it that we have to have if we're going to live someplace? And most of us, when we move, probably tend to think we're going to live there forever, but there are some fanbies out there that find a new backyard. So, you know, you've got to consider all the things like transportation. And that's not only airlines. If you want people to visit you, you're going to visit people. But also transportation within the town or city that you choose. Recreational activities is usually a big one. We're much more active, of course, as a group than perhaps our parents or our grandparents were. So a lot of people are looking for an environment, because our environment really does shape our behavior. So they're looking for a lot of recreational activities, lifelong learning opportunities. Although there are a lot of things you can do online for free, people are often looking to as a way to interact with other people for that. Mm-hmm. You know, cultural activities, like-minded people. You know, when you had mentioned how you know people that maybe moved somewhere and then they weren't happy, sometimes it could be politics. They might have moved to a place that they found was, you know, too conservative for them or too liberal for them. You know, is there a church or a synagogue or mosque, or if you worship, whatever that would be, do you feel comfortable there? Is there some place you feel good about as far as that's concerned? Volunteer opportunities, again, there's so many out there. but are they close by and can you access them? Work opportunities, of course, work is a big one. A lot of people do say that they want to continue in some capacity working after they leave a primary career or to start up a new business or whatever. So are there work opportunities there? Proximity to water is usually a big one, a lake, a river, an ocean. A lot of people are attracted to water. Medical facilities, that's becoming a bigger and bigger thing because they're actually a lot of places that it's getting harder for especially primary care physicians to be accepting Medicare. There, a lot of them are not. And so I've been really hearing more about that and seeing more about that lately. In fact, they just had some study done, and it was in Texas. And they found out that although, you know, it was only something like 30% of the regular family physicians would accept Medicare. So that's a big one to find out, too. People want to have good health care, but, you know, you're going to have to be sure if you're on Medicare that they're going to be accepting that. Sometimes they will. But you have to get in under your regular insurance before you hit 65, and then when you're under Medicare, they'll accept it. So that's an important one, too. Feeling safe, obviously, is one that's important. Opportunities to make new friends if you're picking up and moving and you really don't know too many people. We'll talk about that, too, later, how you can make new friends. Being sure it's a viable community would be a big one these days. If you're moving to someplace newer, and we'll, you know, you really need to ensure that the builder is viable and is solvent. You can often just Google the names of the builders or of the developers. If there's a homeowners association, you can ask to talk to the president and to see the books of that and see, are people paying their dues? Because if it's an amenity-rich area, you know, it's got the golf courses, it's got hiking trails, it's got the pools, it's got the fitness centers, it's got all of that, you really want to be sure that if they're promising amenities, they're going to be put in there, or if people are living there, that they're paying their dues. And you know, they share the books with you and let you know how is it doing financially. So that's important. So you really... I guess the basic thing is, you know, thinking about what kind of lifestyle you want and can afford, and not only now but down the line, and think about that. And so those would be some of the things that you need to take a look at.
Okay. Well, all good things to consider, and obviously there's a lot to take into account there when you're making a decision. I've been quite intrigued with the next question on our list. What are some niche or niche, depending on how people prefer to say that word, retirement lifestyles? I know there's people that are, you know, going to retire and live in the country, or there's people that are going to retire and have an RV. But I'm sure you've got a lot more other retirement lifestyles to discuss with us. So why don't I let you take off on that question?
Okay, and you're right. There are so many different kinds of lifestyles. It's like if you have an interest or a hobby on those, there's something out there for you. And let me run through some of the more common ones people are familiar with. One is master plan communities. They tend to be large scale and a lot of amenities, and the emphasis is on that. It's on the amenities and it's on the activities. They tend, again, like I said before, be large, lots of range of housing styles and prices, and sometimes there's a big long build out, maybe 10, 20, 30 years or more. For example, the Woodlands in Texas has something like, oh gosh, 6 golf courses, 100 miles of trails, parks, a spa, lakes, medical facilities, an amphitheater, a conference center. So master plan communities, they often tend to be gated, which a lot of people like because of that security. So that would be one example. They usually also have these homeowner associations, and some people love them because they feel it keeps the value of their home up. And some people hate them because they don't want to be told that they can't put their trash can out until after 6 p.m. on Wednesday night for the pickup, or that they want to change the color of their house and it has to go before the architectural review board to be approved, or they want to redo their landscaping and they have to get permission to do that. So an HOA is a big thing. If you haven't lived under one before, some people chafe under them and some people love them. So it's something to think about. Another one would be active adult communities, and they're come under many names, age-restricted, age-qualified, age-targeted. They've been around for about 50 years. Probably the big name everyone recognizes is Del Webb and active adult communities. Usually you have to be 55 or older, at least one person, but because of the tougher times now in the housing market, they've dropped and some of those down as low as 45. Some have a limit of or a minimum of like 62. They, again, are often gated, so if safety is an issue, say that's one of your prime concerns, there's a feeling of security there. Some people like them. They like not having the pitter-patter of little feet around from children. I mean, there's usually there are restrictions on who can visit you and how long, if you had grandchildren or whatever, your children to come and visit you. Some like the idea it's more homogeneous, and for some people they don't like it because it's homogeneous and you have these people of about the same age altogether. So that would be one too. Del Webb is big. There's actually one in Florida called the Villages that a lot of people have heard about before. It's got 80,000 residents right now, and it's still growing. It's so big, it's got its own zip code. Hovnanian is a big one in the Northeast, and Robeson is out there in Arizona and Texas. One thing about active adult communities, though, is when people get in them and move into them, they tend to like them and they tend to stay. So if you're on the younger end, like 55 or whatever, my advice to you would be look for a newer active adult community, because you'll find that the average age is going to be lower. So that's active adult. Another one is called CCRCs, another kind of a lifestyle. And a CCRC, some people know about them, some don't. They're called continuing care. It stands for continuing care retirement communities. And in these CCRCs, and sometimes they're called life care communities, these could be good if you feel, you know, you really have to take care of yourself for the rest of your life. You're not going to be able to, you don't have children, you might have a spouse, but, you know, you're both looking to kind of set things up so that you're taken care of. CCRCs have areas where you can go from independent living to assisted living to maybe Alzheimer's care. So it's sort of all on the same campus. You might actually move buildings, but you're sort of in one place. There are different fee structures associated with them. They can be expensive. Sometimes there are different scenarios. You can buy services a la carte if you need them. Sometimes, you know, if you pass away, it can go to your heirs. Sometimes there'll be a refund if you move out or you're gone for any reason. So that's a CCRC, and that's something really the contracts are, you know, fairly involved, and be good to have somebody look that over before you would go that route. Co-housing. Co-housing is kind of a cool one because this is something that actually started in Denmark, and it's collaborative. It's also called collaborative housing. It almost is sort of like the old commune, but not really. But in co-housing, you have residents are involved in planning the community. You have shared decision making. You generally have some shared spaces and facilities like a home or a house where you can make meals for everybody, even though you have your own kitchen and your own individual residence. And people will contribute to their community without, you know, getting any kind of compensation or being paid for it. So you can have as few as 7 to as many as 70 or so generally in these little co-housing communities. And there are about 225 of them in the U.S., and there's actually a website. In fact, I have a friend who's very interested in that. She's single, and she said, you know, I want to go into a co-housing community because I like that idea of having that built-in support. And there's a website. Mm-hmm. It's cohousing.org, and it talks about all the different ones that are being built. And now there are ones that are called elder co-housing communities specifically with minimum ages of 55 and over for people looking for that kind of a lifestyle. So that's something that some people may know about, but maybe not that many.
Okay.
Another one is called new urbanism or traditional neighborhood developments. And this is, if you ever saw The Truman Show with Jim Carrey, that was filmed in Seaside, which is in Florida, which was the first new urbanism community. And new urbanism communities are built, and the idea is to promote kind of neighborliness, and you have a very kind of a compact setting. You have homes, a lot of density, whether it's homes or townhomes or condos, but they're all close together. They tend to have the alleyways for the single-family homes in the back of the house so that the garage you enter from the back of the house, so they have front porches in the front. They have lots of sidewalks. The idea is make it like a community where people are going to see their neighbors, are going to be out there, and you should be able to walk anywhere within 10 to 15 minutes from one end of the community to the other, and they will have stores, they will have restaurants, and you can get there by walking throughout your community. Mm-hmm. And these are real big. These are real popular. There are over 600 of these being built in the United States now. There's one called Baldwin Park in Florida. There's one called Kentlands in Gaithersburg, Maryland. There's one in Oregon called Northwest Crossing. But these are very popular, and especially with this idea of walkability. And a great, if people are looking for a place to relocate, there's a great website. It's called Walk Score, like WALKSCORE.com, and you can put in what community it is or what town it is, and it will tell you how far is it to walk to a restaurant, to a library, to a grocery store, to a church, or whatever. So you get that idea. Is it a walkable community? So when we can no longer drive, if we're looking down the road, these walkable communities are huge. Another example, kind of a niche, is this NORC. A NORC stands for Naturally Occurring Retirement Community. And these are ones that kind of develop naturally. People tend to stay in one place, they age, and then suddenly the entire community is relatively old. So you might have more than half the residents are 65 and over. They have sort of a floating definition of what a NORC is, but they found that they're trying to bring services to people in these NORCs, Meals on Wheels, helping people, organizing volunteers, getting people in there to try to help them so that they can stay in their residence as long as they can. Mm-hmm. College towns, we all know, is a big, important niche, not that it's so much of a niche, a tiny area, but that, generally the housing prices are stable. You usually have lots of cultural and recreational activities, often good medical care if there's a hospital there, maybe lots of good bars if you're into
right.
that. The big thing about that, though, I always say is that, keep in mind if you're looking for a part-time job, maybe you'll be competing with 30,000 students who are also looking for a part-time job, too. But anyway, that's a big one. Then you get, like you had mentioned, city living, country living. Living abroad is a big one now that, places like Panama, Costa Rica, Mexico, Belize. There's a book called How to Retire Overseas that's written all about that, moving overseas, going through the logistics, how do you do it, getting more money for more bang for your buck by moving to a place like Panama, Costa Rica, Mexico, Belize, etc. Actually, my husband's administrative assistant moved to Boquete, Panama, and just loves it. She and her husband moved there. They didn't know a soul, and, you know, she sends me all these updates and all the things that they're involved in. So it was not only a money-saving issue, but it's just she's an adventurous person, learning Spanish and just loving it. Then you get a lot of other kinds of communities. You can live on a ship. For example, there's the world of residency where people actually live on a ship. A woman actually in my neighborhood now had lived on the world of residency, and it's not inexpensive, but it's a cool kind of a niche sort of a community. If you're an amateur astronomer, there's something called Arizona Sky Village. It's built in very low light pollution areas, and they have an observatory there that people can use. For the military, there's something called Air Force Village. If you're an officer, have been an officer in any of the armed forces, you'd be eligible to move into that. There's a place in Central Florida called Nalcrest. It's a community just for postal workers. Manufactured homes, which is, of course, is a big business in the United States now. If you love Martha Stewart, there's a builder named KB Homes that builds homes that Martha Stewart has influenced by her homes in the Northeast. They're similar to those in Florida and Colorado and North Carolina and California. There's things called pocket communities. They're almost sort of a little bit like co-housing. You have, but you maybe only have 12 to 16 houses and sharing amenities such as maybe garden or a common house. Again, oftentimes they're infilled in larger communities, but you have this idea of a little pocket, close-knit community. Another one is multi-generational kind of living where, gosh, just in the USA today, there were some statistics about multi-generational living that now 11% of kids live with at least one grandparent. And in those homes with the one grandparent and a kid, about three-quarters have a parent in there too. So you've got three generations living in a house. This is a big exploding thing, partly because of the economy, but this idea of multi-generational housing. Then there's sort of what can be called home sharing or chosen family or sort of the Golden Girls method where, you know, you go with a group of friends or a small group or say both your spouses have died, your women and both your spouses have died and you live in a house together because think how much farther your money will go. You know, you have to be sure you're compatible and all of that. But those are all examples of different kinds of communities. I mean, there are just tons of them. There's ones for racetrack drivers. There's ones for wellness. Really, again, almost RVs you had mentioned before, just any kind of area that you are interested in.
All right. Excellent. Well, that's a lot more different niche retirement lifestyles than I'd ever been aware of. That's amazing to know about all of those. So what about your next question that you put on the list? I'm fascinated to know what's this. What about the community beyond your immediate neighborhood?
Yeah, and that's something I think we all need to look at. You know, you might find the perfect neighborhood and you just love it. You love your style of homes. You have the amenities that you want. You can hike and all in your neighborhood. But I think we have to look and see what is our surrounding larger community like. For example, is there free shuttle service when we get to the point maybe we can't drive? Is there something that will help there? Is there stuff like, you know, wide grade sidewalks throughout the community? Longer times at crosswalks can be a huge thing to just be able to get across as we get older, looking ahead. Grooved lane dividers, dedicated left turns, brighter lighting on streets and larger signage. Once we get out of our community, these are all things communities are starting to look at to be able to accommodate as the population ages. One-stop shopping if you have you know, aging information and services, that you're not given the runaround, but you can maybe call the Council on Aging in your community and get help if you need a social worker or other services. It's all combined together, and it's easy to access. Having medians, they call them refuge islands, and the medians of two-way streets, so people crossing the street can get there and sort of have a refuge in the middle without having to cross a whole street. Mm-hmm. Some cities have set up, and I think this is a brilliant idea, carrier alert programs, that the letter carriers will check on people that they know are maybe alone or older, because some people, you know, who's going to be looking after them? They can make sure if their mail isn't being picked up, they will check on them. So I think that's mm-hmm. a great kind of a thing to have. So those would be the kind of things to look at your larger community, besides the medical facilities and the transportation, but some of the things of just your daily errands that you're doing or whatever. Are they looking ahead to make it easier as we age?
Well, that's certainly important things to consider. I know that I had this strange, to me it was a strange idea come to me the other day when I was trying to find a place to park at Walmart, and in my small community, Walmart is where I go for my groceries. Otherwise, I'd have to drive another 30 miles to get to a grocery store. So I was trying to find a place to park at Walmart, and I got close to the store, and then I realized all the spaces there were handicapped spaces, so I didn't qualify for them. And I was starting to think, well, as our communities age, are we going to end up with entire parking lots of handicapped accessible? Or handicapped, not accessible, but handicapped, you know, how many handicapped spaces are we going to need as we get older? I started to think, we're going to need more of these in the future.
Well, you're absolutely right. I'm actually on the board, on our library board in our community, and that's one of the big things. The library is heavily used, and it's used by, you know, older adults. And mm-hmm. right now, although the number of handicapped spaces is correct for what the calculation is for the number of spaces and what we need in our population, it's never enough. And so we're having to, you know, increase the number of them. That's an excellent point. Yeah.
Well, it just never occurred to me until I thought, oh, that looks like a great space. And oh, no, I can't go there.
And maybe some places actually will deliver the groceries to you. So, you know, maybe when you get to that point, that would be a good service to have, although people want to keep their mobility as long as possible. But,
right.
You know, if you have a Publix or a Giant or whatever your grocery store is, well, they deliver what you need to you and help with that, too, as people get older.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that, you know, you talked earlier about the concept of moving to a new location, and one of the things that we have to ask ourselves is how would we meet people when we get to a new location? And you said you would be talking more about that, so let's discuss that now.
Okay. Yeah, there's a few thoughts here. One thing, these master plan communities, active adult communities, they usually have full-time lifestyle directors. So if you want something sort of set in place where you can join in as much or as little as you want and somebody else is organizing it all, then these kind of communities can be very good. If you're not, even if you're outgoing or not outgoing, somebody else is organizing all different kinds of things. You know, think about if you're in good health or even if you're not, you know, different kinds of sports. I mean, pickleball is one that's sort of a newer sport that sort of a cross between like tennis and badminton, I guess, would be the best description. You don't have to be that active, but any kind of a sport, tennis, swimming, where you can go out and meet people. You can... Another thing is to think about a newer place where there's an influx of a lot of people from different areas. It can often be easier to meet people.
Because everybody's new.
Because everybody is new. I mean, it's kind of funny. There have been some articles about, you know, like mean people in these communities. They sort of form their clique, and then somebody else tries to join in. So, you know, you have to kind of look at that and be sure that it's a welcoming community. But oftentimes newer ones, and say like in Vegas or Florida, where you get influx of people from a lot of different areas, sometimes can be easier rather than, say, a very small town maybe where you love the place, but it's a little harder to break in. You know, so you could go to fitness classes, take up Zumba, volunteer, of course. You can meet a lot of people that way, attending events, that educational events such as the library might offer. Of course, you can stick flyers in your neighbor's mailboxes and invite them to your house. If you have a pet, to walk your pet, that's always a good way to meet people. Through your religious organizations is a good one. There's one really neat thing if people aren't familiar with it. It's a website. It's called Meetup, M-E-E-T-up, meetup.com. Mm-hmm. And that has, oh gosh, hundreds and hundreds of different kinds of groups that will meet. You can put in your zip code and you see, you know, it could be Chihuahuas, it could be learning French, it could be people who like to rock climb, it could be people who want to discuss books, and, you know, could be gamers on the computer. And if there's not something there that you find is your passion, you can create your own group. So these are very popular kinds of things where at least you know you're going to have something in common. So anything that you like to do when you join something like that, that would be a good way to go about it. And so those would be, you know, some simple ways of meeting new people.
Excellent. All right. Well, another crucial thing I think we have to decide when we're making a decision to move is should you rent or should you buy? And I know that when my husband and I about 5 years ago moved into the community that we live in now, we chose to rent first, and then we would get a chance while we were renting to know the community and figure out exactly where we wanted to live before we bought. Although I must say that the place that we rented was a old school that had been converted into condos. And I found out once we I thought it was really cool because it's very historic and it was very convenient and everything. But what I found out is there weren't very many renters in this building. They were mostly all owners. And so the owners looked down their noses at renters as, you know, renters are not reliable or something like that. So I immediately, I just have to show you the story. The first weekend that we were in this place, there was a knock on the door, and this guy, and it's Saturday morning, I'm making pancakes, and this guy is at the door. He shoves his hand at me. I want to welcome you. My name is Bobby. I'm the head of the association here for all the owners that are in the building. I want to welcome you, and you're parked in the wrong place.
You bring up a good point about a lot of the communities. Yeah, people are renting or they do rent. It's a great thing. You should, you know, try out a community before you decide to live there. But there does seem to be some kind of tension sometimes between, say, full-time residents or people that are renting in a community. Yeah, it's. and your story is a perfect, horrible example of that.
Yeah.
It is.
Oh, and I had no idea I was parked in the wrong place.
Yeah, really. I know. And, oh, my gosh. Welcome to the neighborhood, huh?
Right,
That's terrible. Well, you know, it's a funny thing you mentioned. We're bringing up this renting and all because the New York Times just today had this survey done, and it's talking about home ownership, and one of the questions is how important a part of the American dream is owning a home, and 90% of Americans are still saying yes, even though you may know Susie Orman now is saying to rent. She's saying to rent, and it really kind of depends on your situation, I think, because, you know, there are good things to be said about a home, obviously. Well, first, you brought up the great point about trying out a place, you know, to jump in and buy a place where you're not really even sure if that's where you want to live. Nope, that wouldn't be too good to do, although a lot of people do it. But, you know, Susie Orman saying you should rent, but, you know, and if you're not sure about your future retirement money, it could be better to rent. You know, you don't have the property taxes, you don't have, up, you know, the upkeep, you know, maybe some of the utilities are included, but, you know, if you're a homeowner, it is considered part of the American dream. People think of it, you know, just like you said, there's this tension. Sometimes they see renters as not being as committed. You know, is there some discrimination against them if it's largely a residential area and you're a renter? You know, you tend to know what your mortgage payments are going to be. You can change. You have the pride of ownership. There's some tax benefits, although they're talking about changing some of those things now. But there's one quick and dirty rule you can look at it to see, is it a better idea to rent or buy? It's the you take your cost home and you divide that by the amount it would take to rent a similar home. And if the number is more than 9, consider renting. Like a specific example, say you can buy a home for $180,000, but to rent a home like that, it costs $2,000 a month. If you divide that $180,000, the cost of a home, by $24,000, the amount to rent it for a year, you'd get a number that's under 8. And that would mean it would be a good deal to buy it. But let's say that same $180,000 house cost $1,000 a month to rent. Then, you know, if you divide that $180,000 by $12,000, the perceived rental for a year, the answer is 15. So it would be a better deal to rent it. So you can do that in sort of a quick and dirty way to see, is it just good from that point of view? But obviously, if you're not sure you're going to stay there or whatever, especially in these times, it'd be better to rent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, given that much of our, you know, that's a good piece for thinking about where we're going to go and, you know, but I think we should get down to the nitty-gritty of how do you actually find a place. I mean, there's so many things I think we have to consider.
Well, there are, and one thing is where people vacation. A lot of times, you know, if they choose to go back to the same kind of a place, especially if they're going to have, you know, two homes or one home, we haven't even talked about that, but if you have two homes and one can be more of a laid, kickback kind of area at the beach or whatever, but where you tend to go for vacations may in some way dictate the kind of thing. If you're always going to historical places, you know, maybe you'd like to move to Williamsburg, Virginia, and or help you dictate that. But some easy, free things to do, and these are a few websites. One is called topretirements.com. At topretirements.com, they have a free thing called Retirement Ranger. It'll ask you questions, and it'll generate a list of potential places. There's another one. It's findyourspot.com, another free online quizzes that'll help you clarify what your priorities are and give you a list of suggested places. There's an organization I used to speak for about 4 years. It's called livesouth.com. They have free real estate shows, mainly in the Northeast, and they have lots of representatives from different master plan communities there, and you can talk to them. So that would be an example. Bestplaces.net. They have a quiz, online quiz there. If nothing else, some of these will help you narrow down what's important to you. Where to Retire magazine, if you're not familiar with that, a lot of libraries will carry it too. You get 6 issues a year for $18 and lots of stuff about where to retire. Discovery tours, lots of big master plan communities will offer these inexpensive tours so you can go and stay there and actually get a sense of the community, maybe, you know, play around the golf, eat in the restaurant, but talk to the residents, of course, not just the people who are trying to sell you the place, but talk to the residents. You could also, one thing I'm getting involved in, it's right now, it's just in the launch, it hasn't been launched yet, but it's in the planning stages. It's called Wisdom Retirement, and the site is wisdomretirement.com, and it's sort of serving as a consultant right now, but it's a way to help with all facets of retirement, whether you're relocating, working, health, travel, financial planning, volunteering, kind of that one-stop shopping. And you can sign up on their site, no obligation. And when we do launch, you know, you'd be contacted and see if you're interested. But that's wisdomretirement.com.
Okay, excellent. Well, I know that probably got people that are wanting to ask us some questions, and I'm looking at our time here. We've already gone a little bit over our hour that we mentioned, but I still, you gave us the definition of one of these retirement or vocabulary terms that have to do with relocation, FANBY, but there were some other ones that were things that we promised to tell people about, splitters, sunbirds. I guess you mentioned the ACCRA already was the organization
right.
that has the cost of living report with the quarterly numbers. But what about ARBs and RUPPies? Let's get some
okay.
definitions.
A RUPPY, it almost sounds like a roofie, like the date rate drug, but it's
right.
a RUPPY. RUPPY stands for retired urban people who like to live in cities.
Mm-hmm.
ARBs are these architectural review boards, things you may have to pass through if you have a homeowners association, if you want to change the color of your house or whatever. Splitters are people who spend their time in two or more places. They are splitting their time. Most of us are familiar with the snowbirds, people that are going from the snow to somewhere warmer in the winter, but there's also a reverse migration called the sunbirds. They go someplace cooler north in the summer. So that's one you don't hear as much as the sunbird. So those would be some examples. One of my favorite ones actually is doesn't even have to do with relocating, but I love it. It's called it's called Kippers, K-I-P-P-E-R-S, and it stands for Kids in Parents' Pockets Eroding Retirement Savings. I think that one's really good. A kipper. So
okay.
You don't want to be kippers. All right, so those are a few.
I guess, now, did we get to splitters? Did we talk about splitters?
Splitters, yeah. They're people who spend time in two or more places. So say you
okay.
have, you know, live in New York City
All right.
and then you have a place in the beach, in Naples or something.
All right. Okay, well, excellent. We've had some great discussion here, and I think what I'd like to do now is open up the call so that all of our guests have a chance to talk and see if we have any questions. I realize that we've gone past the hour that we promised, so I realize some people might have needed to leave or something if they only allowed an hour for the call. But I know that there's got to be questions, so anybody here that would like to ask a question? All right, well, don't be shy here, but I've got a question that came in through my screen here from CJ in Upper Nyack, New York. She says, or I assume it's a she, more and more people are choosing to retire overseas. We alluded to this a little bit earlier. While having one's money go further in a foreign country is a good benefit, there are some very real practical considerations about living outside of the United States. And she says language barriers, cultural differences, less stable governments, that's one that always concerns me, health care, mm-hmm. living in a country where you don't have the benefits of citizenship status would certainly be among things to consider. So she says, would you please share your thoughts and insights on overseas retirement?
Okay. Yeah, and it's a great question, and she brings up a lot of the points that people have to be aware of. How are they going to handle their medical things? Because you're not going to have Medicare over there if you're living in another country. There are two organizations I'd kind of recommend. One is called internationalliving.com, and they do lots of actual groups that go to these different kinds of places and look at what's available and answer all those kinds of questions. And then the other one is by this author of Retiring Overseas, this Kathleen Petticord, who addresses a whole lot of those questions and what her answers are. And yes, the cultural thing, I mean, she has a list that will go down and say, you know, well, if you're not familiar or if you're not happy, especially with that idea of mañana, that we will get to your issues mañana, and mañana could be 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, 5 weeks, like my friend in Panama experiences
mm-hmm.
that quite frequently, that you have to have a particular mindset that you're okay with that. If you're a type A personality and you're going to be moving to a place where their culture is much more relaxed and laid back, yeah, you're going to have a problem with it. It is a good way you can save money. Your money will go farther. You know, on the other hand, if you're looking to maybe move to Paris or someplace else that's more runs along the lines we're thinking of, it's not going to be an issue. But how are you going to do all that? And that book, that Retiring Overseas by Kathleen Petticord, goes through all the different kinds of questions. Buying property can be another issue. You know, some will not allow mm-hmm. you to buy property close to a beach. You have to go through a certain way in order to be able to actually buy a house and live there, but you don't really own, you can't really own the property outright as an American living overseas. So it is a big issue. There are a lot of people, though, that are doing that and that do that, but you really almost have to have a certain kind of personality. You have to be open to things. You really should be willing to learn the language. To go over there mm-hmm. and then expect it to be like the United States, you know, you're really setting yourself up for failure on that.
Right. Well, I know I have a business acquaintance. I only see him at conferences, but he and I have talked on the phone, and he's moved. He and his wife have moved. She's lived all over the world, apparently. So when they got married, it was a second marriage for each of them. She, you know, just assumed that they would continue to be, you know, very expatriatic in their lifestyle, because that's what she was just used to for her whole adult life. So they moved to Mexico, and he spent, you know, some time, a significant amount of time at a conference, telling me, this is a couple of years ago, oh, how wonderful it is. And I'm now thinking about him, and I'm thinking, you know, I don't really know if I would feel safe with all the drug situations that are going on there. So I think that, you know, this is something that there's lots of pluses and minuses, and a person has to make some decisions on it. You're saying that these websites like Catherine Petticord's can help you to know what you need to be aware of?
Yes, they do. And they sort of vet a lot of the communities so that you do feel safe, or there's so many expats there already, Americans, it's sort of like a microcosm. But, but there are some in Mexico that, you know, wouldn't be advisable anymore because it is a little too close for comfort to the drug trade going on there. But there are other ones, that are pretty much more established and so almost too Americanized, that, you know, with mm-hmm. the Costcos and the Walmarts and everything,
right,
that are much more removed from that. So it's the due diligence, just like living in a, you know, in a big city in the United States. Some people would be frightened about that because of the safety issues. So yeah, there certainly are a lot more things to consider besides, you know, just you can get more for your money there. That part is true. And international living, some of the places they're putting forth, are like Nicaragua, some emerging countries, which, you know, I wouldn't be for me, but some people are much more adventurous than I am and would be willing to go. They're, you know, touting Vietnam and all kinds of places. And, of course, there's, with 78 million boomers or close to 78 million, there's really, like we said, something out there for everyone. So some people may relish that thought of moving into a developing area. I need the infrastructure myself, you know. I kind of like some of the basics. But, you know, she
right.
did bring up some excellent points. There are a lot of questions you need to answer for yourself before you make a decision like that.
Well, certainly I agree, especially you've touched on some really important ones, but I think healthcare is something where some countries are really good with it. You know, where I've heard that I'm familiar with some of Catherine Petticord's information and she talks about, you know, healthcare in some countries that you know, you can get fabulous care that she tells you, you know, for pennies on the dollar compared to what we would pay here in the United
yes.
States. So,
and there's also that whole area of medical tourism that
right.
people are going for, you know, facelifts and all different kinds of things because you can have a great quality of care, but that's another thing you'd have to be careful about. You know, just like in the United States, there can be care that's better than other care depending upon where you are too.
Right. Now, let's talk about getting, not necessarily leaving the country here. What specifics do women say that they want in a home? Are there certain things that you've seen that we should be all
yeah,
looking for?
Yeah, there's been a lot of surveys now. Like I mentioned, that women are the second largest group of home buyers now. Single women are, but single women in general, what they found from surveys that they're looking at. They, you know, smaller is okay. They really talk about a lot now people downsizing. Yes, some do, some don't, but they certainly want the feeling of space. So the kitchen, of course, is very important. Walk-in closets are important. Low maintenance, you know, why condos are also very popular because they're low maintenance. An island facing a great room, a kitchen garage to store some things out of sight, this universal design principle, a laundry room with a long counter. I mean, some of these are pretty specific. A laundry room that's close to the master bedroom, an idea of a first floor master, high-speed internet. Women say they want green building, but they really don't want, you know, there comes quickly a price at which they don't want to pay for it. Generally about $5,000 extra if it adds to the cost, then they shy a little bit more away from that. Residences that are considered like zero net, that they produce as much energy as they consume, like through solar design and insulation, high efficiency window and appliances, you know, home systems that can control and monitor your energy. I guess if you can figure out how to use them, some of those things are pretty complex.
Right.
That, you know, that can lower your running cost to 50% or more. Now, of course, these are newer homes, so that are going to have all these bells and whistles on a lot of it, especially with all this high efficiency stuff. So that would be another consideration. Are you looking for a newer home? That idea of safety and security. So activities, they're looking for, you know, proximity to shopping, fitness centers, dog parks, walking paths, a lot of health programs, wellness is big. If you're single, clubs for singles, or, you know, the ability to easily institute some kind of a group of your own in a community. So those would be some examples.
Excellent. That's an extremely complete list there. I think that you did a great job going through all the things that we women want in a home. So now we just need builders to hear all of that. So, all
well,
right,
I think they're starting to listen.
Well, that's good. Anyone else have a question? Well, you're being shy out there and thinking about it. I want to remind all of you listeners that Jan's website is called Moving from A to Z, and you can find it at www.thenewretirement.net, spelled out exactly like it sounds. And also on the website, there's information about a number of seminars that you and your partner offer, which go into a lot more detail on the topics that we've touched on this evening. I think some of the key ones that I noted you listed are what women want and need in retirement, what is the new retirement, what are the secrets to a successful, fulfilling retirement? How can you reprogram your time? How to choose the perfect place to relocate? And then more on the niche retirement lifestyles that you did such a great job of telling us about here this evening. Are there any other seminars that you think people should know about? And how do people get involved in one of your seminars? Is it mainly through these organizations that I mentioned earlier that you have provided content for?
Yeah, generally, yes. I'm hired by a company to do a presentation for a group. I'd say the one where I used to do the talks for the seminars, that Live South, and I actually did four for them last winter, but that's sort of a hit or miss thing. So I don't do them so much on my own, but through this Wisdom Retirement, that would be more of a way. That wisdomretirement.com would be another way to get more specific information once that whole entire concept gets launched.
And when do you think that might be, Wisdom Retirement?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. I'd say within the next 6 months.
Okay. Excellent. All right. We're past our time here that we promised, so I'm going to say one last chance for people to stop being shy and ask some questions. Do it now. All right. I'm not hearing any questions, Jan. I'm just going to close the call. I think it's been great talking to you this evening. I want to thank you for being my guest and for the great discussion about how to plan for where we will live in retirement. And unless there's anything else that you want to say, I'm going to give you that chance. And otherwise, I'll thank everyone for joining us.
Well, thanks. I do apologize for running past my time.
No.
And I appreciate the opportunity and certainly enjoyed the evening.
I always think it's a great discussion if we go past the time, but sometimes we lose people, you know, that have booked themselves
for
the 60 minutes.
Sure, I understand. People have busy lives, and I can completely understand. Well, if you get any other ones, just pass them along to me, and I'll answer them through your website.
That sounds like a great idea. Thank you, Jan, very much for being my guest. Thank you, all of you quiet listeners out there, for joining us, and I'll say good night.
Okay, thanks so much. Goodbye, everybody.
Bye.